Welcome back. Steve Winwood, Roll With It. The musical wunderkind when he was only 16 years old. I believe he was 16. He was asked to join the legendary rock group Traffic. Imagine, 16 years old, living the high life. And of course, he went on to have, and continues to have, a remarkable solo career. Back to more of my conversation with Dan Riskin, author of Mother Nature Is Trying to Kill You, in just a few moments. Just wanted to remind you to hang in. George Knapp, the intrepid George Knapp, will be with you tonight. And he'll have Bruce Maccabee, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, a U.S. Navy research physicist, on the program to discuss FBI and CIA documents proving that they investigated UFOs. But as we'll find out, both agencies have actively tried to conceal this from the public. But in the first hour, Mr. Knapp will be joined by Billy Cox, journalist for the Herald Tribune in Sarasota, Florida, who writes about UFOs in the Devoid blog. He'll talk about his extensive research into UFOs and why there's still a stigma attached to believing. Chapter 6 of Dan Riskin's book is entitled Wrath, as he explores the natural, the world of nature through the eyes of, through the lens of the seven deadly sins. Wrath. Nature is a violent place, he writes. Everyone knows that living things are killed by other living things all the time. And yet, despite that fact, people cling to the myth that nature is peaceful. There's a make-believe world where even the predatory animals are gentle, if you just take the time to get to know them. Most of the time, believing in that fictional world is harmless, but in a worst-case scenario, it can get someone killed. Back with more of my conversation with Dan Riskin right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dan, Chapter 6 in your book, Wrath, you talk about how people have this, this fantasy that if we just got to understand predators, we'd discover that they're just gentle creatures, misunderstood creatures, and no greater example, perhaps, than the killer whale, which is aptly named the killer whale. It is a killer. And of course, now around North America, we have, SeaWorld and a lot of these types of parks no longer keeping killer whales. And some people say, well, that's good, keeping these beautiful creatures in captivity, it's cruel. But there's another reason that they're not being kept, and that is because they're just darn dangerous. Did we lose Dan? Oh, there we are.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, it's true. It's amazing how impressive. There's a whale named Tillicum that lives at SeaWorld, and this is the focus of a great documentary called Blackfish. But this killer whale was captured off Iceland when it was a little thing, and some people say it's because of mental turmoil. Who knows why? But this killer whale with two other whales at a park in Victoria, Canada, one day managed to get its hands on a trainer, a young woman who worked there, who slipped into the pool. And they basically, these killer whales just played with her until she was dead. And then they quickly got the whales out of there, and this whale went to SeaWorld. And then at SeaWorld, everything was going fine until somebody decided they wanted to go swimming with a killer whale. And nobody really knows exactly what happened, but somebody snuck into that, somebody went into SeaWorld when it was open and then didn't leave when they closed. They hid somewhere. And then the next morning, their body was found in the pool with this whale. But the clues about what might have happened are that this person folded their clothes neatly next to the pool, and they had huge bite marks on one leg, and a bathing suit was found at the bottom of the pool, and his naked body was found draped across the whale's back in the morning. So what probably happened, my guess, is that this person thought maybe it would be nice to interact with the whale in some kind of a nice way. Maybe by sitting at the edge of the pool and dangling their feet into the water, maybe by swimming with the whale. It's very cold water. They may not have known that. But in any case, either the whale grabbed this person by the leg and pulled him into the pool, or he was swimming and tried to get out and the whale grabbed him by the leg and pulled him back in. But he had cuts and bruises all over his body. His bathing suit was taken off. His scrotum was ripped open, and he was demolished, and he had drowned. And nobody really knows what this person was thinking getting close to that whale, but it seems like they chose to have that interaction. And so that's why I say that you know, it's a bit of an obscure example, but having this misconception that wild animals or the big predators really are Disney creatures that want to give you a hug if you just manage to look them in the eye properly. You know, people get killed at zoos all the time when they get in with big predators, and killer whales are no exception. Now, importantly, there are, to my knowledge, I could not find a single example of a killer whale killing a human in the wild. It just doesn't seem to happen. But what killer whales do to their prey is very similar to what's happened to those people. And you know, what they'll do is they'll practice hunting. They'll beat up on a prey like a sea lion or a seal. They will catch it and then let it go and then catch it again and let it go and catch it and let it go. They will throw it in the air. They'll beat it with their tail. They will injure it and then let the babies, let the young killer whales chase it down. They do all kinds of things that are sort of reminiscent of the way a cat treats a mouse when it brings it into your house. But they're vicious predators. And the nail in the coffin for that particular whale was that a trainer was next to the pool at SeaWorld. This is the same whale that now has killed two people. This trainer was next to the pool at SeaWorld, and Tillicum grabbed her by the hair, pulled her into the pool, and then played with her until she was dead. And those aren't the only incidences of people being injured by these killer whales in captivity. And so I think there's a general rising tide that people feel like killer whales just don't belong in captivity because it's not nice to the whales. But yeah, the other side of the coin is it's not nice for the people that interact with the whales either. And you know, they're big predators, and they deserve our respect, and that doesn't make them evil. That doesn't make them bad. Nature's still beautiful and wonderful, but it needs to be respected. And when you see a killer whale, that's a beast. I mean, that is a creature that can literally take down something like a baby blue whale, when they work as a pod. So they are creatures that know what they're doing, and they're amazing, but they're dangerous.
Absolutely. Now, the porpoise or the dolphin, on the other hand, and actually, is a killer whale a whale or is it a porpoise?
There are two kinds of whales. There are the toothed whales and the baleen whales, and the porpoises and the dolphins are members of that toothed whale or the toothed whale family. So a dolphin is a kind of whale. Is the easy answer to that.
And dolphins and porpoises, they get all the good PR. We love to watch dolphins swimming in the water, and we hear these stories, they may be apocryphal, of people being lost at sea and being rescued by dolphins and porpoises. Is there any truth to those stories?
Yeah, my grandpa used to tell a story. He was sunk in a ship in the Second World War, and he says that there were porpoises in the water helping out. And he's my grandpa, so I have to believe everything he says. But it may well be true. I mean, dolphins do crazy things in captivity, and they're very smart and they're very social, and they look like they're always smiling. But you know, there are people that there are these people that want to give birth in the water with dolphins because the dolphins are going to act like they're helping out or something like this. What's really cool is if you're pregnant and you're swimming with a dolphin using its echolocation can actually see your fetus because whereas a bat echolocating can only see the exterior surface of something and see just the way we see the exterior surface when we look at things. Echolocation in the water moves through water very well and just reflects off a bone. So when porpoises and dolphins are using their clicking sonar, they're seeing the skeletons of all the fish around them because that's what the sound bounces off of. And when if you're pregnant and you're swimming with a dolphin, it can actually see your fetus. It can see the skeleton of the fetus inside you, which I think is just super cool. But the other side of it is that they, you know, if you look at the behavior of dolphins in the wild, there's forced copulation happening a lot. You have very aggressive males, like two males will gang up on a female and drive her away from the rest of her pod and force her to mate with them multiple times without letting her go back to her group. And you get other examples of behaviors in dolphins that aren't quite so cute and cuddly. So, you know, and people that I've talked to that have interacted with dolphins in pools marine show kind of thing, say that when a dolphin is in a surly mood, you have to be careful. They can hold their own. They can push you right out of the water if they want to. And so, it's another example of an animal that we like to sort of tell these stories that, oh, it's Flipper. It wants to be friends with us. It has nothing better to do with its time than to hang out with humans. And it likes nothing more than our approval and to give us a cuddle. But really, animals don't really care that much about us. And sometimes they like to check us out. And sometimes you get pets that get attached. But for the most part, dolphins, let them be.
Let's go back to the phones, and the first-time caller line, Jay, is in Long Beach, Washington. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning. Hi. How are you?
Hi there. Welcome.
Okay, thanks. So I have been wanting to talk to a bat expert for about a month now. I like to relax on my deck, and I live right by the bay, Willapa Bay, just right on the edge of the world here, the Pacific Coast. And where the deck roof meets the house, there are at least, well, I've seen four, but one that likes to devil me. There's bats that fly in and out. And when I go out to relax, like say if I went out there right now, I flip on the light. And they're fast, as you know, I'm sure. I want to find a nice way to get them to live somewhere else so that I can relax on my deck without, these things zeroing in by my head or flying too close.
Fair enough. I think I can help you a little bit. So the first thing I'll tell you is that in China, to have bats in your house is a sign of good luck, just to make you feel better. Some people really like to hear that. And I personally have always wanted bats to live in my attic and have never been able to get them to do so. So I envy you. Bats living in your house, for the most part, are not going to cause any problem. They're not a health hazard unless you have a lot of them. If you have like thousands and thousands of bats in your attic, then their droppings can start to accumulate and that can create problems. But just a few bats doesn't cause much of a problem. And the other thing is that those bats, like I said, can eat 600 mosquitoes an hour each. So they're doing you a favor. Now, that said, if you still don't want them there, it's tricky. So if you can fit your thumb into a hole in your deck, that is big enough for a bat to crawl in and out of. So if you go to all the trouble of excluding bats from your deck, you're going to need to make sure that when you're finished, it's sealed up well enough that the bats can't come back in. And so for a lot of buildings, that's just not going to be an option. Because if you got them out and they can get back in through a myriad of holes, then you're going to be kind of stuck. But the trick is, the first thing you got to do is you got to make sure you do what I'm going to tell you at the right time of year. What you don't want to have happen is that the bats have babies living in your attic, and you kick the adults out, and they can't come back and feed their babies, and then the babies starve to death and die in there. Because then you have dead baby bats, and you have that on your conscience for the rest of your life, that these cute little defenseless animals died at your hand. So you don't want to do what I'm telling you in the spring. But if you do it in the midwinter, it's going to work really nicely. What you can do is... If you figure out which hole they're exiting through, if it's just one hole, you can take a bread bag, like a plastic bread bag, and cut it on the end so that it becomes like a sleeve that's open at both ends, and then you tape it around around that hole during the day. And then what happens is the bats come out at night, they come to the exit, they find this weird bag there, but they can find their way out no problem. They descend down the bag, they fly out, they do their thing, and when they come back, they cannot figure out how to get back in. And that is how you can exclude bats. But again, you got to make sure they don't have babies living in there, which will happen in the spring. And then the other thing is, why not buy a bat house, which you can buy online or you can build yourself. There's a great organization called Bat Conservation International. They sell them, and they're a great group to support. And if you put a bat house out on a tree across from your deck, then maybe you get the benefit of having the bats around still without having them in your house. So that's what I'd recommend. But if it were mine, I'd leave the bats in there because it'd be a source of pride.
All right, Jay, hope that is helpful. I'm sure it is. Thank you for your call from Long Beach, Washington. Getting back to your chapter on wrath in the animal kingdom, we were talking about the killer whale and so forth, but some of the deadliest creatures are seemingly, rather innocuous looking. Like, for example, and I believe it's one of the most deadliest creatures responsible for a lot of deaths, and that's the jellyfish.
Yes, Venom changes everything. Venom is like my favorite thing in the world right now. You know, you're trying to write a book about how Mother Nature can be kind of rough, and then you realize venoms are out there. Venoms only exist to hurt other creatures or kill them. That is their only purpose. And venoms exist in all kinds of different creatures, from scorpions to spiders to ants. To jellyfish. And venoms are different from poisons. A poison is something that you shouldn't eat, but a venom is something that is stabbed into you to hurt you. And it's amazing that all these creatures will go to such lengths. But yeah, jellyfish have... of course, these microscopic barbs that they fire into your skin, and some jellyfish can penetrate your skin and some can't. So some jellyfish don't even hurt, even though they're doing their best to hurt you, and other jellyfish can cause real problems, even death. But the most deadly of all the creatures is one that you wouldn't suspect at all, and that's a snail. There's this snail called a cone snail, and there are actually a few hundred species. They live in Southeast Asia, and what's amazing about these snails is they feed on fish, and they do that by firing this venomous barb into a fish while it's swimming by. So a fish swims up to the snail to check it out, and then this harpoon shoots out and goes into the fish, and it kills it. And if you're a scuba diver, and you try to pick, and they're gorgeous, right? They're these beautiful cone snails. You try to pick one up, it'll fire this thing in self-defense, and it'll go right through your wetsuit and into your finger. And the nickname for these snails is cigarette snails, because if you've been stung by one of these things, you have enough time to go smoke a cigarette, and then you're dead. 5 minutes. It's unbelievable. And there are thousands of different chemicals in this venom, and they don't even know exactly how it does its trick, but it's apparently painless and very, very fast acting and one of the most deadly venoms that exist. Now, it's very rare for people to get hit with this thing because you have to go scuba diving at night in Southeast Asia, which hardly anybody does, and those people who do know not to pick up those snails. So it's very rare that somebody gets hit by one of these, but they are deadly. And the people who work with them in the lab, I mean, it's like having a spitting cobra in the corner of the lab. They're deadly.
Talk to me about the spitting cobra. I mean, it's not enough that we have, you know, these king cobras with huge fangs. Now we have to worry about cobras that are actually able to spit their venom at you from across the room and what, hit you in the eye?
Yeah, they go for your eyes. God, they're cool. They go for your eyes, and the good news is that
that's not cool. That is cool.
Because, well, the happy news is that it can't kill you if it gets in your eyes. It just really hurts. But if it does bite you, that can kill you. The snakes are incredibly dangerous. You know, I as a biologist, you tend to try to say, like, oh, don't worry, snakes, you know. And the truth is, like, you don't really have to worry about snakes, especially in North America. Snakes, it's very rare you're going to come across a snake, maybe a rattlesnake that might bite in self-defense. But even rattlesnakes are very, very, very rarely deadly. It's just not something to worry about. But with that said, there are other parts of the world, like Bangladesh, where thousands of people die every year because they live in rural areas with no access to medical help. They're walking around with bare feet in agricultural areas, and the snakes that happen to live there are not snakes you want to play around with. And so there, by some estimates, 25,000 to 125,000 people die every year because of snake bites. And we don't even actually know the numbers because in some of those rural areas, it's so hard to keep track of what's happening. And what's neat about snake venoms is that some snake venoms can kill you because they drop your blood pressure so low that you die, and then other snake venoms increase your blood pressure so high that you die, and then other snake venoms clot your blood so you die, and then other snake venoms prevent your blood from clotting so you die. And so you get this whole range of different physiological things that the venom can do. And if you're a doctor or if you're a pharmacologist trying to find an element that you can use to control blood pressure, for example, snake venoms are a very good place to look to find some of the chemicals that can work so well, because evolution has been shaping these chemicals inside the venom of snakes to work really well in mammals. And you're a mammal, so
that's very cool. I guess if you get bit by a snake that is an anticoagulant venom, you got to go out and quickly get bit by a snake with the opposite effect. Dan Riskin is with us. We'll continue our discussion. Mother Nature is trying to kill you right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome back. Joe Cocker bringing us back in with When the Night Comes. barrel-chested, stocky gentleman from Sheffield, England. Not a lot of musicians from the Woodstock era that are still standing, let alone flourishing, the way Joe Cocker is. Now, what is it? Now, 6 decades into his career. If you ever get a chance to see Joe Cocker live in concert, it's a great show. Dan Riskin is giving us a great show. The author of Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You, and we'll get back to that conversation as well as your calls in just a few moments. Here's a little trivia question for you. Speaking of the animal kingdom and deadly creatures, what do you suppose is the deadliest animal in North America? Maybe you're thinking sharks. Well, shark attacks account for maybe a half dozen deaths in humans every year. Maybe you're thinking about bear attacks. Only about 150 deaths over the last century, so it's not the bear. What else could it be? What could be the deadliest animal in North America? I think the answer is going to surprise you. It's certainly not the wolf. You know, there's not been one reported death at the hands of a wolf in North American history. Not ever. The answer? The white-tailed deer. That's right. The white-tailed deer, the deadliest animal in North America. And it's not because, these beautiful, elusive creatures are attacking humans. It's because they wander out onto the highway causing car wrecks. And back in about 2001, I think, alone, 83 deaths in 1 year. 83 deaths attributed to the white-tailed deer. Back to more of my conversation with Dan Riskin right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dan Riskin stays with us, and we'll get right back to the calls here, and we'll begin with Rick in New York, east of the Rockies line. Rick, good morning. Welcome.
Yes, hi there. There's one animal I don't think you guys have covered, and I believe that's baboons.
All right, a pretty ferocious critter, the baboon, Dan.
Yeah, no, baboons are smart. I haven't had a lot of interaction with baboons, but those who have tell me stories. They're too smart, so they're almost like a human. And so there are all kinds of stories of them breaking into people's houses in Africa and just wreaking havoc on things. When I was researching this book, the problem was that it was an embarrassment of riches. One of the challenges I had with this book, which was really fun to write, was that I just had so many stories and animals that I could go into. And so, as you alluded, Richard, I organized it around the seven deadly sins. I thought, wouldn't it be fun to try to do the seven deadly sins and see whether I could find examples of nature doing it even better than humans do? And that was what constrained me. And so a lot of stuff ended up on the cutting room floor, and a lot of things went unexplored altogether. And baboons, I'm embarrassed to say, I just never got to them. So maybe for the sequel.
Thanks for the call, Rick. A creature that similar to the baboon that I just find very intimidating, to look at through a cage at the zoo, and that's the mandrill. They are just one ferocious looking creature.
Primates are crazy. I mean, it sounds like it'd be really fun to work with primates and stuff, and never mind the stories about chimpanzees ripping people's arms off and massacring their faces and stuff like this. Primates are just smart, and that makes them really hard to work with for researchers. And it's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's great. It makes them so cool to learn about. But I have friends who, I studied how vampire bats crawl. I have friends who study how primates crawl. And you can imagine that when you're doing a study like this, what you do is you build a force plate, so like a bathroom scale, and you need your animal to step on that so that you can measure how it steps. And if you're doing it with an elephant, no problem. You walk it down the track, it'll step on the plate, you'll get your force, it'll look beautiful. You can do it with an emu, you can do it with an ostrich, you can do it with whatever you want. But if you try to do that with a primate, the primate knows what you're doing. It says, I'm not going to step on that. And so then, like, it just goes, it jumps over it, it hits it with a stick. They're not cooperative at all, and it's almost funny. You got to respect your research creatures, and you got to love that nature is full of these smart animals that are laughing back at us.
You mentioned the chimpanzee. I mean, just again, they get great PR, but there have been a number of horrible, tragic cases where handlers have had their faces literally ripped off. It's almost as if the chimpanzee has this cruel aspect to them. I mean, or can we even use that word when we're describing the animal kingdom? Cruel. That's, I'm anthropomorphizing, aren't I?
Well, yeah, so that's one thing people have accused me of is anthropomorphizing. But, you know, I'm not writing a scientific paper here, and I think our conversation is valid. I mean, what we're talking about is how people perceive nature and the kinds of ideas that they have going in. And to me, it's not a matter of cruel or ethical or anything like that. It's just these are animals that have their own lives, that do their own thing, and they are not being nice. It's just, they're just being animals. And so, you know, if a human did it, it would be cruel. If a human did a lot of the things, you know, if it did what the bed bugs do, you know, to mate, it would be unthinkable. But when a bed bug does it, it's just a bed bug mating, and we got to not get too worked up about it. And so, you know, Jane Goodall famously really had a hard time when she realized that the chimpanzees that she was studying were killing one another, and she really had a hard time coping with that. Because she had sort of this idea about what chimpanzees were all about, and then she had to integrate that new information with the way she thought about her creatures. But the, you know, the one that gets me is the orangutan, right? So orangutans are like, you know, these friendly, cute creatures that live in trees and they're vegetarian, and wouldn't it be nice if we could all be orangutans, and they make nests every night and they sleep in them and they're just so cute. But there's a great paper that I found about orangutans feeding on slow lorises. And a slow loris is just an adorable little primate with these big eyes. They're just so cute. And There's this story about orangutans, and the researcher didn't just say an orangutan ate a slow loris. It explained exactly what it does. And, you know, what the orangutan did was, like, you know, to smack the thing out of a tree, go down and pick it up, and then it ate its brain, and then it ate the palms of its hands, and then it ate its organs, and it did all this in a specific order. And this is a creature that's supposed to be this vegetarian nice thing, but the truth is that a bag of calories went and sat on the tree next to it, and animals are opportunists, and so, you know, maybe just a little bit of meat supplementation here and there is fine. And it doesn't matter how cute the animal is that gets killed. Orangutans are in it for the calories too. So it's, people love to pick their animal and think about, put a poster on the wall and say, oh, they're so cuddly and cute. But animals are animals.
Spoken like a true biologist, a bag of calories.
Yeah, well, that's what we are, right? I mean, and that's the beauty of it, is we're all bags of calories. And you know, plants are the only creatures that can really make a living without hurting anyone, because plants can get all the energy they need from sunlight, and they can pull their carbon out of the air, and they can just live their lives. But for the rest of us, for animals, all animals, we have to kill or injure things in order to survive. I mean, I can't get through a day without eating. I'd probably last about a week if I didn't eat anything. But to eat, I have to either kill animals, or I have to kill plants, or I have to at least injure plants. And so you can try to make as little an impact as you can by eating sustainably from plants and only eating fruits that fall off the tree and all this stuff. But pretty soon you start to get pretty hungry living that way. And that is not, this is not just a human thing. It's true for every insect, every mammal, every bird. We all make a living by taking food either from plants or from other animals that originally got the food from plants. And so thinking about how that energy flows and the fact that we are just all bags of calories, that's a big part of how the world really does work, and a big reason why we can't all be friendly to each other all the time. The truth is, we have to eat.
What are the real man killers in the animal kingdom? And I'm not talking about, a case of mistaken identity. Let's say where a great white might mistake someone in a scuba gear for a seal. I'm talking about animals that actually like the taste of human flesh and will seek us out as a source of food.
Well, so if you want to get into the charismatic ones, polar bears will definitely hunt people, and that's one thing that's super cool about them and super terrifying about them. But really, the answer is a lot less satisfying, because the answer is mosquitoes, and mosquitoes are incredibly good at finding us and taking our blood. But mosquitoes drop off little passengers, and there are all kinds of different creatures. Not, thankfully, not so much in North America, but things like malaria, elephantiasis, all these other diseases get dropped off by mosquitoes, and that's what kills people. I mean, roughly the population of Chicago dies every year from malaria, and that's something we get from mosquitoes. And so, you know, we think about parasites as just this minor thing because we live in North America where we've done such a good job of keeping the water clean and controlling the quality of food that gets onto our plates and the cleanliness with which that food is treated. You know, we live in this nice bubble where we don't really have to deal with the realities of the way nature works. But the truth is that there are all these creatures that are looking to get at some of those calories in our bag, so to speak, you know, that are trying to live off of us so they can either just get some food or so they can make babies. And some of them, I mean, so there's a worm that lives in your, so you get bitten by a mosquito, it goes into your bloodstream, and then it finds itself in your lymphatic ducts. And your lymphatic ducts are these little, they're almost like blood vessels, but blood doesn't go in them, lymph does, and they drain your tissues. So if you get a swollen foot, the reason it won't be swollen a few days later is because the lymphatic ducts are gonna drain the fluid out of there. Well, these worms go and live in the lymphatic duct, and they're a few inches long, and they cloak. They have an amazing ability to hide from the immune system, and so you don't even know they're there, and they can live there for like 30 years. So you go to Vietnam on a trip and you get bitten by a mosquito and you don't even know it, but you've got these things living in your lymph ducts. And then 30 years later, they die of old age, as every worm would hope to do. And then all of a sudden your immune system realizes there's the corpse of a worm in there, and it inflames, and it sends all this the blood, and it starts to try to fight the infection, and you get swollen. But all of a sudden there are all these corpses of worms that are blocking your lymph ducts. So then you can't reduce the swelling. And so you end up with this monstrous, ridiculous swelling, and that is what elephantiasis is, and that's how people get elephantiasis, and that disease is spread by mosquitoes, and it's just one of many diseases you can get from a mosquito. So I'd love to just rattle off, you know, these big carnivorous animals that can really do damage to us, but the real answer is mosquitoes, mosquitoes, mosquitoes.
All right, Lou is in Redding, California this morning. Hey, Lou, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good morning. I have a problem that I've had for like at least 6 years, and I've been to several doctors. They've never heard of it before, and dermatologists never heard of it, and they just think you're nuts. And one of them yelled and screamed at me to just get out of his office because I wouldn't take his antipsychotic drugs. But I had to get a veterinarian look at slides for me. And she told me it was called walking dandruff mites because they get underneath a dandruff, and as it moves, that's how they nicknamed it, walking dandruff. So, and there's a lot about it on the internet, but they told me that one veterinarian told me you can't kill them by anything you put on the body because they live underneath the skin. I got them from my dogs and cats that got them from the rats. I had rats in my walls, so I was poisoning them. I felt bad about it. But anyway, the dogs would lick the rats and then get them on them, and so I ended up with them. Now, I have them all over my body, and three of my dogs are extremely sensitive to them. The other two dogs aren't very sensitive to them. And my daughter, she's in her 40s, but she's not real sensitive to them, but I'm extremely sensitive to them.
Oh, dear. Walking dandruff mites, Dan, that sounds like a nightmare.
It does sound like a nightmare. And, you know, I work on this show with Animal Planet called Monsters Inside Me, which is about parasites and the infections that people get. And, you know, I just feel so much sympathy for people because sometimes you get something and the doctor's like, okay, there it is. It's real simple. It's you have a worm in your eyeball, but we've seen this one before, no problem. Or we, you know, an amoeba that's, you know, under your skin. But there are these infections that the doctors just don't know that much about. And sometimes it's because they're from other parts of the world. And sometimes it's because they just happen so infrequently and their symptoms can be so similar to other things that the doctors really are at a loss. And my heart absolutely goes out to people that suffer like that. And Lou, definitely, it sounds just terrible. It reminds me of another infection called Morgellons disease, which is something you might look into. I don't know if you've read up about that, but that's another one where it's an infection of the skin that a lot of people have, and the doctors just seem to be at a loss to figure out what's causing it. And sometimes the doctors do sort of think that maybe it's all in the patient's head, and that can be very frustrating too, and there's the stigma around that as well. But, you know, the best thing you can do is just be persistent and do lots of research and see if you can figure out what you can about it. But I would recommend staying away from herbal remedies and things. If you can find a doctor or a medical professional or a researcher who's studying that kind of mite, maybe a veterinary specialist who studies how it affects dogs, for example, that's going to put you in a better position to really understand what's going on than to go too far into alternative things. Because what ends up happening with rare diseases is these alternative therapies prop up and they're almost impossible to evaluate. And so you end up with just spending a lot of money and time on things that aren't really going to help you. And so I hope that you get better soon. I hope it doesn't last very long. I've not come across that particular kind of mite before, but I've come across other things like it for Monsters Inside Me, and I hope you get better soon, because that's just got to be really tough. The last thing I'll say is, usually if you're really having a tough time with something that's giving you strange symptoms, ask to speak to either a parasitologist or a tropical disease expert. Now, in your case, it looks like it's not a tropical disease, so that might not carry, but for other listeners who are suffering from strange symptoms, when I had my botfly, the first doctor that looked at it, and it was a botfly, which is a pretty common thing, relatively, the first doctor said it was an ingrown hair and just wouldn't hear me out. And then I said, well, do you have a tropical disease person? And then before long, I had a whole class of parasitology students looking at my head together. So it's just a matter of getting the right doctor who's got the right background.
Good luck with that, Lou. Wishing you all the best. Thanks for the call. We just got about a minute and a half here, Dan. Is there one story, one particular creature that even shocked and maybe even appalled you as you were putting this book together, Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You?
You know, what really struck me was that as I was writing this book, my son was born, and I was spending all this time writing stories about how animals do these ridiculous things to pass on their DNA and how they'll do anything for their offspring, and I was laughing at them. And then all of a sudden my baby would cry, and I would drop the computer and run upstairs and then bounce this colicky baby for like 2.5 hours straight, just bouncing. And I remember thinking, oh yeah, I'm one of those animals. And the connection, there's a lot there about nature and where we come from. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what it means for how we can live in nature. And just because nature is kind of rough with us and doesn't really care about us, there's no reason to be mean to nature. And I really think that there's a really positive message that comes out of the book as well, just in terms of how we can be at one with nature without having to lower ourselves to the kinds of things that nature does. And so, I just hope that the book turns a couple people onto biology. I hope that somebody reads it and it makes them laugh and then they decide they want to take some classes. That's what I hope.
You should be commended and congratulated for making science so exciting and fun and accessible. Mother Nature is Trying to Kill You. Dan, I've enjoyed our time together.
So have I. Thank you so much for your time.
All right. For George Norrie, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Chris Burrows, Sean Lattiser, Brian Opry, Tricia Pepe here in Toronto, Gord Harris, Scott Gaston, Jackie Salas, I'm Richard Serrett. For Coast to Coast AM, thank you for your ears and your beautiful voices. Good night.